It's the morning show on a Thursday morning. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And when Wisconsin voters adopted our state constitution way back in 1848, they endorsed these words, quoting, "All men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights," end quote. But despite that declaration, everyone in the state couldn't vote. Those rights were reserved for white men over age 21, with some exceptions. It took nearly 20 years and a Supreme Court case before black men could vote in Wisconsin, and then it took several more decades before women could vote. How did this come to be? What forces shaped the building of our state, and how much do you remember from your fourth grade trip to the state capitol? We're exploring Wisconsin history this morning by revisiting a conversation from the morning show's archives. Here's WPR host Molly Stentz talking with Christy Clark Pujara, an associate professor of history in the African-American Studies Department at UW-Madison.
Well, I want to start with the Constitution and 1848. Now, the Constitution that voters adopted then wasn't the first draft, and in fact was pretty radically different than an earlier draft that was proposed. Can you start us there with what that looked like, that process of forming our Constitution?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin was supposed to become a state in 1846. You could apply for statehood if your territory had amassed some 60,000 people. That was like the threshold. And after the lead rush in the Wisconsin territory, there was enough people to apply for statehood. And so Wisconsin was up for statehood in 1846, convened a state constitution. And a couple of things really tanked that first constitution. One of them was a referendum that was attached to the 1846 constitution that required an immediate vote on black male suffrage. That was deemed too radical. And when we get to the 1848 Constitution, black men are explicitly banned from participating in the electorate.
Now, what changed in those 2 years?
I don't think much changed. I think that the referendum was always going to be a long shot. And I think it was always going to be a long shot because, like white Americans throughout the nation, white Wisconsinites understood citizenship and whiteness to be one and the same. They understood black people to be outside of the nation and not a part of the nation. And that's just not my opinion. It's in the history before the state constitution convention convenes. In the Wisconsin territory, we have prominent citizens who are holding people in bondage for several years, holding black people as slaves in bondage in the region where slavery is not supposed to exist. And so it's not really surprising that the white population in Wisconsin sees black people as lesser than and not part of the electorate.
So what kind of rights did African Americans have at the time?
They didn't. They were not recognized as citizens of the United States. We tend to think about the experiences of black people in this period. And so let's say, you know, from the Revolutionary War through the American Civil War, really simplistically, like they were either enslaved in the American South or they were free in the North. And that technically was true. Although slavery falls apart in the North really slowly and haphazardly. And just to give you an example of that, the state of Rhode Island didn't abolish slavery until 1848. The state of New York didn't until 1827. New Jersey never does. But the bulk of black people in the northern states and in some Midwestern territories are free, but they are people who do not lack who do not have access to liberty. They're not voting. They don't sit on juries. They are banned from the militia. They attend segregated schools. They attend segregated churches. It's a Jim Crow society. We tend to associate that term with the South, and it came into being in post-Civil War America. But the northern states and territories functioned in the way that the Jim Crow South is going to function 150 years later. So black people are free, but they do not have liberty. And in places like Wisconsin during the territorial period, they weren't even free, despite the ban on slavery in the Northwest Territory. Slavery was functioning as an institution because no one was enforcing it, and it was accepted among the white population there.
That's right. So you have territorial ordinances banning it. You have the Constitution coming into effect, also saying that slavery is not legal in Wisconsin. Yet, how much longer did it persist in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to take a longer view of this. There's a long history of race-based slaveholding before Wisconsin is ever Wisconsin, right? And so you have people of African descent that are held in bondage in what becomes Wisconsin during the French territorial period in the 1720s, right? And then you get a larger number of enslaved people in the region when people like John Roundtree and Henry Dodge and George Jones bring enslaved people into the area. These are some of the founding fathers of the Wisconsin Territory. And some of them are from places like Missouri, where they were holding people in lifelong, perpetual race-based bondage. They bring those people with them to the territories where the ban on slaveholding is not enforced. Historians, I'd say for the past, 10, 15 years, have really been doing a deep dive into the practice of slaveholding in the Midwest. And what we found is that the ban on slavery in the Northwest Territories wasn't worth the paper it was written on. You have people being held in bondage at military forts, and those people were actually being supported by the federal government, meaning if you were a military officer who was stationed somewhere like Fort Crawford, you would be paid an allowance to have either a servant or a slave serve you and your family. So it was the practice. Now, are we talking about lots of people holding lots of people in bondage? No. I'm talking about hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people being held in bondage. But what is clear is that it wasn't shocking, it wasn't scandalous, and it wasn't contested until statehood became evident. And once statehood becomes evident, you see the manumission of people who were never supposed to be held in bondage. And it's a weird thing to sit in an archive in a place like UW-Plattsville and read manumission papers, right, these freedom papers of people who were never supposed to be held in bondage in this region, to read suits of black people who sue for their freedom because they know they're not supposed to be held in bondage in this place. So it's really interesting, but it's also really telling about, there's the law and then there's the practice.
Right. It reminds me why we have the Juneteenth holiday and how long it took for the country to wrestle with this question. Now, you mentioned Henry Dodge, and I'm curious to know what we know about his practices. The territorial governor who you mentioned was a slave owner.
Well, most people in Wisconsin, I have kids that are in elementary school now, they're going to learn about Henry Dodge or see, a park, something, a pavilion named after him. But what we don't
hear city.
Is about, yeah, what we don't hear is about Toby, Tom, Lear, Jim, and Joe, who he brought and held illegally in bondage for 11 years in these territories. Right, who were enslaved here from 1827 until 1842. And they built his fortune. Right, there are reports that, these enslaved people were bringing up 2,000 pounds of lead a day. He was making tens of thousands of dollars off their labor, and they did not benefit. When they're emancipated, he pays a bond on them, which again is confounding because this institution is not supposed to exist in the territories. But these are incredibly liberty-loving, resilient people who some of them go ahead and establish Pleasant Ridge, which becomes this free Black homestead outside of Lancaster, Wisconsin, where Black families find a place to be free, right? And Black people can test their bondage. You have someone like Paul Jones, who sues George W. Jones for his freedom, and he sues him for an exact amount of wages, meaning this is someone who was keeping track of what he thought he was owed, and he knew he wasn't supposed to be held in bondage as a free person in the territories. He loses his case and is emancipated a few years later. But that kind of action tells us about the active endeavor it is to hold somebody in bondage, especially people who know they're not supposed to be held in bondage and who are contesting that illegal practice.
That's UW-Madison history professor Christy Clark-Pujara talking with WPR host Molly Stentz. And we'll pick up this conversation about Wisconsin history in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Exploring Wisconsin history on the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and do you know the name Ezekiel Gillespie? It was his actions, his desire to vote in Wisconsin back in 1865 that led to a lawsuit granting voting rights to Black men. It paved the way for a more inclusive state, one brick at a time. So let's pick up learning about Wisconsin history from UW-Madison professor Christy Clark-Pujara, who's talking with my colleague, Molly Stentz.
Christy, what do we know about Ezekiel Gillespie?
We know quite a bit about Ezekiel Gillespie. We know that he was most likely born in bondage. We know that he bought his freedom from his enslaver, who was also most likely his father. We know that he migrated to the Midwest in search of freedom, like free Black people throughout the nation. There were some 60,000 free Black people that migrate into what we now call the Midwest, and they are free and they are looking for a place to live with liberty. And he first is in Indiana, and he ends up coming to Wisconsin, like many free Black folks from places like Indiana, after the fugitive slave law is passed. And Black people become even more apprehensive and less secure in their freedom. They're trying to get closer and closer to Canada if they need to make a run for it to protect themselves and their families. He was a family man. He had a total of 11 children. Two were adopted. He lost two wives, so he was widowed twice. He was left to raise young children on his own, which he did with great dedication. He was an entrepreneur. He sold groceries and foodstuffs in downtown Milwaukee and advertised his foodstuffs for sale in the paper that was edited by Sherman Booth, who was also a white abolitionist lawyer. He works as a porter for the railway company, becomes a very valued employee. And while he's doing all of that, he's also civically involved. Black people in Wisconsin, free Black people in Wisconsin, because when the state is founded in 1848, it is founded as a free state, and there are no more enslaved people of African descent. But this free population is very aware of their marginalization, and they begin to organize early on to strategize about how they get access to the ballot box. There are, you know, several referendums that, you know, fail. And Ezekiel Gillespie, along with other Black men, do things like show up to their voting places, right? These tax-paying men, and ask for the right to vote. And
what happened? What happened when he did try to vote? And that was 1865.
Yeah, that wasn't the first time he tried to vote. That was the first time he tried to vote and took Sherman Booth with him so he could witness him being turned away so he could then file suit, right? So they're turned away. They're turned away. They're saying, you're black, you can't vote. You don't have the right to vote in this state. And it's, you can just imagine how infuriating that must be because black people by this point in American history, many are 10 generations deep. The vast majority of black Americans today trace their ancestry back to the colonial period, right? And so Ezekiel Gillespie is being denied the right to vote as a many generations deep American, and he's standing next to white immigrants who have been in the country maybe just a few years, because you didn't even need to be a citizen to vote in the state of Wisconsin. You just needed to be a white man over 21 who had lived here a year. And if you weren't a citizen and a white man, you just had to declare an intention, right? That's how conflated whiteness and citizenship were in early Wisconsin. And you can imagine someone like Ezekiel Gillespie that's many generations deep, right, being denied the right to vote in a place where he pays taxes in a state that declares itself free, right? And so he sues for his freedom. It works its way through the courts rather quickly, which is an indication that the court was looking to take up a case like this. And the Supreme Court rules in his favor. And they rule in his favor not because there's a shift in thinking about black men and their access to the ballot box, whether they're worthy or not, whether they should have the right or not. The court rules on a technicality. In 1849, so just after, a year after the 1848 Constitution is ratified and put in place, the Republican Party gets a referendum on black male suffrage on the ballot. But the vast majority of white men, and it's only white men voting, right, don't vote on the measure. Let me look at my numbers. So 5,200 approve, 4,075 say no, but about 32,000 don't vote on it at all. And the State Board of Canvassers takes those abstention votes and counts them as no votes and says black men can't vote. And the 1866 Supreme Court case says that what the Board of Canvassers did in 1849 was wrong, that they should have never considered the abstentions as no votes,
so,
and only counted the votes cast.
So everyone who did not vote in that election was automatically considered a no vote to be against suffrage.
Yes. Right? And the thing is, there are two more referendums after that. And in those referendums, the vast majority of white men vote on them, and they vote no, about 60%.
So the
Supreme Court rules what happened in 1849 was wrong, and so those other referendums don't even count, including the one that happened in 1865, which also was a no by 60%, right? That none of those count because what happened in 1849 was technically wrong.
But it took almost two decades for the courts to hear that challenge.
Yes.
And then
black people are organizing. They're meeting at churches. They're talking about this. They're attending political conventions in places like Chicago, because this is an issue for free black people throughout the North and the Midwest. How do we get the rights of citizenship?
We're speaking with Christy Clark Bujara, history professor of African American Studies Department at UW-Madison, taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. So, Christy, this Supreme Court case in Wisconsin's history after these decades establishes black male suffrage, but it takes us several more decades to achieve women's suffrage. What happened over that period of time?
So women's suffrage in Wisconsin is like women's suffrage throughout most of the rest of the country. So women are organizing here. I have come across no evidence of any kind of interracial cooperation. What I have come across are white women using black men's access to the ballot box to argue for themselves. They say things like, even black men are allowed to vote and we're not. How horrible. Mm-hmm. And so they actually make a racist argument about how they should be allowed to vote because black men can vote in the state.
Wow.
And, you know, women don't gain the right to vote in Wisconsin until the, you know, the 19th Amendment is passed. But there is no, you know, cooperation between black and white women as. And that was pretty true throughout the country. Most white suffragettes separated themselves from black women who, too, through the National Association of Colored Women, are also fighting for the right to vote. And there were very prominent black suffragists, but we rarely get to know them or talk about them. And so it's important to remember that voting has always been contested in this space. And I think that that speaks to contemporary moments. When we think about who has access to the ballot box now, why we have voter ID laws, what those are intended to do, voting has always been something that has been raced, right? It's been sexed, and it's been contested.
Mm. That was UW-Madison history professor Christy Clark-Pujara talking with WPR host Molly Stentz. Now, to hear more conversations from the Morning Show's archives anytime, you can visit our webpage at WPR.org/mornings. You can download the WPR app. Got a program suggestion for the Morning Show? You can also find our contact info on our website, and that's WPR.org/mornings, where, a reminder, you'll also find a link from our first guest this morning about the summer camp for youth with burn injuries. Now, just ahead, next hour, the director for the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison warns in her new book, A World Without Soil, that global soil erosion is an invisible crisis. Dire, in her words. And we speak with a biologist and author about the harms of worldwide soil erosion after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.